Pepe, and I'm a drug addict.
Pepe.
And first of all, I want to say I want to thank the committee for inviting me here to share my experience, my strength, and my hope. You know, it's an honor for me and a privilege every time I'm asked to share, because I believe what this fellowship says, it is in giving that you receive. And God knows I don't want to lose what I have. And, you know, it never ceases to amaze me every time I see big crowds like this at a convention, because when I came, NA was very, very small. In fact, the first meeting I attended to was in 1959. And at that time, there was only one meeting a week in the world. And I remember my first meeting, and I'll never forget that first meeting, because of the things that happened that night. See, I met a guy, the way I was introduced to this fellowship is I met a friend when I was in an institution in Los Angeles. I was in a mental institution at the county hospital. I was in the mental ward there. And the reason why I was there is because I had an overdose. See, I had been using a drug called Dolaphine for about 19 months. And I was, and the last few months of my using this drug Dolaphine, I was drinking very, very heavy. And consequently, I ended up in the psycho unit there with an OD. And in those days, they didn't know how to withdraw you from methadone, because that's what it is. They call it methadone now. So what they did is they just cut me off of the methadone, and they gave me something for the nausea, and they gave me something for the pain, and they gave me something for the diarrhea, and they gave me something for all these symptoms that I had, and I almost died. It's the worst habit I ever kicked. And I was in the intensive unit there for about 3 weeks. I had tubes in me and everything. And after I was able to get out of the intensive unit, they put me down in the regular ward with all the rest of the nuts. No. When I was down there, one day a fella came in, and he introduced himself, and his name was Scott, and he asked me if I had ever heard of an organization called Narcotics Anonymous. And I told him I never had. And he said, "Do you know anything about an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "Well, I know it has something to do with the schedules, with the winos down in Skid Row, but I don't know anybody that's associated with that, you know, organization." And I didn't know anything about AA or NA. And for the next week, this guy used to come and visit me there in the hospital. And for that week, he shared his experience, his strength, and his hope with me. And after a week, I was getting ready to go before the judge. See, because in those days, the only treatment there was is they would send you to Patton State Hospital for 90 days, put you in the ward with the rest of the nuts, and after 90 days, they'd cut you loose. And that was their treatment in those days. They had two other hospitals and that treated drug addicts, but one was in Lexington, Kentucky, and one was in Fort Worth, Texas. But here in California, they didn't have anything. And it was against the law for any doctor to treat you for drug addiction. If you went to a doctor for a drug problem, he had to report you to the authorities. So I had to go before a judge, and he was either going to cut me loose or send me to this state hospital. And this guy asked me, this guy Scott, he said, "Would you like to go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting?" And I said, "Well, I can't leave the hospital. You know, I'm here, and I can't leave unless I'm cut loose by the judge." And he says, "If I could arrange it that he will cut you loose, would you go to an NA meeting?" And I said, "Yes." I immediately said, "Yes." And I said, now the reason why I said yes wasn't so much that I was interested in this Narcotics Anonymous, you know. See, I was a parolee at large. See, 19 months previous to that, I had been paroled from a federal institution in Texas, and I ran. like always, I ran from the gate. I never reported to the man. I started using the first day I got out. And I had used for 19 months. And I was in the hospital under an alias, and I knew that eventually they'd find out who I was, and I'd get violated. I go back. I still owned the federal government 3 more years. So I said yes, that I would go to these meetings. And this guy went before the judge, and he convinced him to cut me loose. And not only that, but he took me to live with him. He lived in North Hollywood on Lancashire Boulevard. He lived right across the street from the Universal Studios. In those days, there wasn't any Universal Studios. It was just a great big empty lot. I got out of the hospital on a Tuesday, and he took me down to his house. And I'd spend the day with him, and right next door to his house, there was an old hotel called the Lancashire Hotel. It was kind of like a Skid Row type hotel. And it had a lot of rooms in there, and one end of the hotel, one end of the hallway, way at the end, there was the men's restroom and the showers, and on the other side was the women's restroom and the showers. And I got a room there, and I used to spend the nights there, and during the day I'd run around with this guy, Scott. And like I said, I got out of the hospital on a Tuesday, and the only meeting there was on Friday nights. And they had the meetings in a little sanitarium on Riverside Drive in North Hollywood called Shire's Dryer. And that's where all the alcoholics used to go and dry up. It was Shire's Sanitarium, so they used to call it Shire's Dryer. and they used to have a little room in the back that they used to let the Narcotics Anonymous group hold their meetings. During the week, we went to some AA meetings. And when Friday came along, I went to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I went with this guy, Scott, and another guy that was staying at this hotel with me. He was from Oklahoma. And we used to call him Bay Rum John. And he was a drug addict that he had hitchhiked all the way from Oklahoma to California, and we both ended up going to our first meeting in NA. And when we drove up to this place, this sanitarium in North Hollywood, we parked on the side street, and right next door to the sanitarium there was a bunch of bungalows, like a little complex of bungalows right next to the sanitarium. And when we got there, there was a couple of police cars there, and there was an ambulance back there, and they had the lights flashing. And we wondered, gee, I wonder what's going on. There's something going on back in those bungalows. So we went into the meeting, and we found out, when we got into the meeting, that one of the members of Narcotics Anonymous who lived back in one of those bungalows had committed suicide. He took his life. And he left a letter. He left a little note. And when we went into the meeting, there was a fellow, the co-founder of Narcotics Anonymous, Jimmy Kennan, was reading this letter, and I don't remember exactly what it said, but the contents of the letter was that he was apologizing to the group. He was saying how sorry he was that he let people down, but that he was tired and he couldn't see any way out. And life to him was very, very dark. And he decided to take his life. And during that meeting, the whole meeting was like a gratitude meeting. Everybody was talking about how grateful they were that they had their health back. Others were talking about they were grateful that they had their families back. And I sat there and I listened to all this meeting of gratitude, and I couldn't identify with anybody in there. I just couldn't identify. The guy I identified with was the dead man. That's the guy I felt close to, because I didn't know what was going to happen to me. See, I had been out of the hospital since Tuesday that week, and it was several days now, and you know what? All that medication that I had in the hospital had wore out, and I was getting sick, and it had been a month. I didn't know it took that long to kick a methadone habit. And I hadn't slept for a couple of days. I was hallucinating that day, and I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I didn't know whether or not I was going to stay sober. You know, And I know that if I did get clean and sober, I couldn't leech off of this man. I couldn't sponge off of this man. I never had worked. I never knew how to work. In fact, I never worked until I came to this fellowship. You know, I've been an institution since I was a young boy. I got busted from my first position in 1947, and I did some time. And until I came to this program to stay, I've spent about 70% of that time locked up in an institution somewhere in the United States, just for drugs. And here I was at this meeting, listening to these people talk about how grateful they were that they had this and they had that, and I was scared to death. I had so much fear. And that night, I went back to that room, and I really hallucinated real bad. And I thought I was going to die. And I thought that I was having these hallucinations that something very evil was going to get me. And I identified this evil with the devil. And I was afraid to go out in the street because it was dark out there. And I thought, if I go out in the street in the dark, the devil will get me. So what I did is I was just petrified. I went to the corner, and I got a blanket, and I sat right in the corner of the room to make sure nobody could get behind me. And I sat there all night. And as soon as the sun started to come up, I left the room and I jumped on the bus and I went to East Los Angeles and I got well. And right after that, I really don't remember. It could have been 3 weeks, could have been 4 weeks. You know, full of drugs and half drunk, I walked into the federal building there on the corner of Main Street and Temple in Los Angeles, and I went up to the fifth floor to the parole department and I turned myself in. You know, and I realize now that, you know, the reason why I used, even though I didn't want to use, the reason why I used is because I didn't know what else to do. I really didn't know what else to do. And the reason why I finally turned myself in is because by this time, institutions had become a way of life to me. You know, I looked forward to getting off of the street, letting them get me off of the street where my life was chaos. It was pain that somebody could put me in an institution and put some order into my life because I didn't have the ability to do that. And institutions had become my refuge. And you know, you get in an institution and you get hungry and you get in that line 3 times a day and they feed you. If you need some clothes, you get in that, you fill out a requisition slip and they give you whatever you need. If you have a toothache, you get in that, they take care of you there. They take care of all your needs. And I never knew how to take care of myself. And I got sent back to this institution in Texas when they violated me, and they sent me back to this place in Texas, which was a hospital that specialized in the treatment of drug addicts. And they didn't keep me there. They found me detrimental to the station because I had been there once before. I had been there for 2 years. And during the time I was there, I had had intensive group therapy, individual therapy. I had had, you know, I had everything that they had to offer there. And I used the first day I got out. So as far as they were concerned, I was a hopeless drug addict. And they transferred me to a federal institution in Leavenworth, Kansas. And during the time I was there, the only thing I remembered was this guy, Scott. I didn't remember the meeting. I didn't remember what went on in the meeting or what they talked about. I remembered this guy, Scott, because he was the first man that I had ever met who was a drug addict. And I knew he was a drug addict because of the way he talked. And he even knew some people I knew. This man had 5 years clean. This man came into the program when Narcotics Anonymous was 3 months old. In fact, he was the fifth member of Narcotics Anonymous. And he became my sponsor. And I thought about this man during the time I was in this institution. And I thought, when I leave this place, I'm going to go back to Los Angeles. And I'm going to look for this guy. And maybe this guy can help me. Maybe this guy can help me. And that's exactly what I did. When I left the institution, I went back to Los Angeles, I looked for Scott, and I found him. And I stayed clean and sober for 6 months. The first time since I had been using it, and I was on the street, I was able to stay clean and sober for 6 months. I didn't work the steps. I didn't work the steps at all. I just went to a meeting every night for 6 months. And after 6 months, I drank again because I had this problem with booze. I used to say, I don't have any problem with drug with alcohol, and I have never had any problem with alcohol. My problem is drugs. I didn't realize at the time that I was an alcoholic. So I drank first, and then I started using again, and I left NA. I never went to a meeting loaded. And I ran crazy for quite a while. And in December of 1962, I went to a place in Santa Monica called Synanon. I went there for the reason to kick. I couldn't do it by myself. And I went into Synanon on September the 6th of 1962, and I left on Christmas Day of 1962. I was there just a very short time. But during the time that I was in Synanon, I remembered what I had heard during the 6 months that I was clean. And I could not deny what I had seen. I could not deny the truth. And the truth was that there was a way out. I had met people who were clean and sober and who were beginning to form a whole new different lifestyle. And I knew, I knew. And I realized that the reason why I used is because, and I was unaware of this during my 6 months. During the time I was going to the meetings, and the reason why I never worked the steps was because deep, deep down inside me, I still believed I had control, that I had power. And I used to think in my mind that if circumstances were different, if situations were different, maybe I could control my using. Maybe I could handle it. And it took what it took. It took this last time for me to go out and beat my head against the wall one more time when I finally realized that belief that I had was an illusion. It was an illusion that I had power, that I could control my life. And it was during the time that I was in Synanon that I realized that there was no way in God's earth that I could ever drink again and I could ever use again and not have and not get hooked, and not end up, in the same situation. And that was when I was able to admit to my innermost self that my life was unmanageable and that I was powerless over my addiction in whatever form it came. I was powerless over all my chemicals. The miracle happened. The miracle happened. I from that day on, I have never had an obsession to use. See, because what happened was that I let go of that illusion that I could control things, and the obsession was part of that illusion that I let go. And I think the thing that saved me was that during the 6 months that I was here, the power that is contained within the first step, the power of honesty, was able to penetrate this thick skull of mine, and I couldn't deny the truth. See, to me, honesty means to evaluate and accept conditions as they are. And the fact was that I had no control. The first step was telling me this over and over and over. Every time I went to a meeting, I heard the first step telling me the truth. But this illusion I had, I believed it. And it was until I let go of that illusion, I became free. And this is just one of the basic spiritual principles of this fellowship. There are many. And I'll name a few and how I understand them. That there's a principle of humility. And to me, humility means to become willing, just to become willing to accept the truth. And when I become willing to accept the truth, what I'm really saying is that I don't have the answers. And I guess it took all that beating my head against the wall for many years to finally get me to that point where I was able to humble myself to that point. And I was able to realize that my best method, my best understanding, my best wisdom, my best everything I had going for me almost killed me. That's how slick I was. And at that point, I became humble. My mind opened. I was willing to open my mind and listen, you know, and accept other ideas and other concepts. I became willing to follow directions. You know. And then there's the principle of honesty, which I spoke about. You know, to evaluate and accept conditions as they are. And with me, that was very hard because when I came here, by the time I got here, my perception of myself and my perception about the world and everything in it was so distorted that I didn't know the difference between what was real and what was not real. These illusions that I had, I believed they were real. I really believed that I could control my life. I really believed that I could handle it. I really believed that if circumstances were different or situations were different, I could use again. And I tried many, many ways. You know, I used to tell myself, well, this time I'm not gonna use hard drugs, I'm just gonna drink. And other times I would say, well, I'm not gonna use and drink, I'm just gonna deal. Or I'm gonna and I tried, but eventually I'd get back to using. And it was until I let go of that illusion and I was able to be honest within myself, deep within myself. And you've heard it many, many times. Know the truth, because the truth shall set you free. Know the truth, because the understanding of the truth will set you free. And this is what it did to me. The basic principle of this fellowship, honesty, freed me from those illusions. You know, and there's the principle of faith. When I came here, I didn't have any faith in any system. I didn't have any faith in God. I didn't have any faith in myself. You know, but it was after I came around for a while and I began to see other people recover. You know, and I began to, and then I began to stay sober. And pretty soon I'd have a week and then a month and then several months. And finally I got a year. And as my time grew on this program, my faith also grew. Because I couldn't deny what I saw. I couldn't deny what I had experienced. You know, I had experience and I had seen things that I had never seen before, and I could not deny them. And because of that, my faith began to grow. You know, and my faith is still growing today. And there's a principle of courage. To me, courage means a state of mind that will enable me to face whatever problems I have to face without having to run, without having to get loaded. And to me, that was very hard because I've been a coward all my life. I've been running all my life. You know, but when I have trouble with this courage thing, I go to the next principle, which is the principle of appreciation, or you can call it gratitude. You know, no matter how bad things seem to be in my life, no matter how difficult situations are in my life, if I can really look into my life, there's always something I can find to be grateful for. Always something I can be grateful for. And there's also the principle of service. Service to myself, service to my God as I understand Him, and service to my fellow man. And here in this program, we really have the privilege of service. You know, and there's many times that we share, you know, not only our experience, our strength, and our hope. Sometimes we even have to share a little money. And sometimes we have to open our homes. And sometimes we have to share our food with other people. You know, and this was so very hard for me to share because for many years, I couldn't share. And the reason why is because I associated giving or sharing with losing. If I gave you some of what I have, I'll have less. And it was very hard for me because I believed in lack. I believed in scarcity. You know? And I was always looking to get. I thought that the way you're going to have anything is by getting it. And this program taught me different. The only way I'm going to get anything is by giving it away. Giving and receiving is synonymous. It means the same thing. And I began to start living by these principles. But at first, I really wasn't too into to the principles. And I'll tell you what changed my whole life. I was sober about 8 or 9 years. And by this time, I was married and I had 2 sons. Now, one son was about 6 or 7 years old and the other one was just a little over a year. And we found out that my 2 sons are sick. My 2 sons have a disease that's called Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Both of them have it. And in the beginning, I didn't know what it was. And I thought, well, at this time, I finally gotten to the point where I had a little business of my own. I had a roofing business. It was prosperous. I was making more money than I ever thought I would ever make. I was able to provide my family with some of the nice things in life, things that I never thought I could ever provide myself with. And I thought, well, I can afford it. We'll get them to the best doctors. We'll get the kids well, whatever medicine they need. And my wife said, I'm going to write to the Muscular Dystrophy Association in New York, and I'm going to find out all I can about this disease and see what we can do to help the boys. And a couple of weeks later, I came home from work one day, and I found my wife in the kitchen, and she was completely destroyed. And I asked her, what's the matter? She said, read this. Well, you know, there's several types of muscular dystrophy. Duchenne is what the children get. And I found out that it's a disease that it's fatal. There's no cure. There's nothing they can do. What happens is they get weaker and weaker and weaker until they get to the point where they get so weak that they catch a cold and they die because they can't fight the cold. And they're lucky if they live to be 17 or 16 years old. And I didn't drink over this. I didn't get loaded over this. But I almost went crazy. You know, the first thing that happened was that all that fear that I had known all my life came back. And I began to feel guilty. Maybe I had something to do with it. You know, all these drugs and all this junk that I put in my system, maybe I caused this. And then later on I began to get angry at myself. I even got angry at my children because they were sick. I didn't want them to be sick. And within time, I became angry at God. I sort of felt like God was punishing me. One more time, He was punishing me. And it seems like when a person is so hurt inside, and he's so confused, that the ones you hurt most are the ones that are close to you. You know, and it got to the point where it was very difficult for my family to be around me. I got crazy. And I couldn't handle my work. I couldn't think. I couldn't sleep. I lost my appetite. Life just didn't have any meaning to me. And I began to get very sick. And the sicker I got, the meaner I got, and the most anger I got. And one day, my wife and I, we got into a real bad argument, and it was over finances. Because by this time, I was up to my ears in debt. I wasn't taking care of business and work. There was no work coming in. I just wasn't taking care of business. And we got into this argument, and before I knew what had happened, I beat my wife real bad. And I black and blued her face. I broke her glasses. I cut her eye. And I had never touched my wife. I had never beat my wife. In fact, I grew up with this thing, man, that you don't do that. A macho does not do that. He does not beat his woman. That's a coward. And I thought to myself, you know, my family, they have enough problems without having to deal with a maniac like me. So I left my home. I moved out. And there was another little house that I had that I owned, and I moved into that little place by myself. And I took care of my family. I made sure that they had everything they needed. I used to go over to visit her once a week, and I get all the bills, and I take her shopping, and I had to take care of my family, and I had to do it for my own dignity. But I escaped. I didn't escape in booze or anything. I escaped in work. And I lost my business. I lost everything I had. So I got two other jobs. I got two jobs. And I used to go from one job, 8 hours, and go to the next job, 8 hours. And I'd come home and I'd crash. I was so tired, I didn't have time to think. And the next morning I'd get up and I'd go to this job for 8 hours, and then go to the other job for 8 hours. I did that for a year and a half. I never took a day off, never took a vacation. I didn't have time for meetings. And after a year and a half had gone by, I found myself that I was very seriously thinking about taking my life. And I remembered this guy at my first meeting, this guy Grant Withers. And something within me told me, get back to the meetings. Get back to the meetings. And that's when I came back. And that's when I really got involved with this fellowship. You know? And I guess at that point, I think I said the most valuable prayer that I ever made. And I prayed, and in my prayer, I didn't ask for God to come and heal my children. I didn't ask God to heal my relationship between my wife and I. I didn't ask God for anything. All I did was I asked God to let me understand what the meaning of all of this is. Let me understand what's going on. Because if I can understand it, I can deal with it. And my desire to know the truth was so strong that the answers came to me. And I remembered a beatitude that I had heard many, many years ago. And that beatitude is that it goes like this. It says, blessed is he who thirsts and hungers for righteousness, for he shall be filled. And what that means to me is, blessed is he who thirsts and hungers. In other words, that strong desire. Blessed is he who has that strong desire for righteousness, which is right perception, true thinking, the truth. Blessed is he who has a strong desire for the truth, for he shall be filled. Because that desire will bring whatever information I need, I will attract it like a magnet. Because it is the law of cause and effect. It is the law. We call it the law of harmony or the law of balance. And this is what happened to me. I wanted to know the truth so bad. My desire to learn the truth was so bad that I got answers immediately. A couple of days later, I met a man that has brought so much information to me. He has answered a lot of questions that I have had all my life. To me, he is the most spiritual man I have ever known in my life. And I had known this man for about 6 months, but we never talked. We never talked. And a couple of days later, we began to talk, and he's my spiritual teacher. He's not on this program. In fact, he used to work for the United Parcel. He used to deliver packages to the house. This is how I knew him. And he is my spiritual. He has introduced me to some people that they're not alive anymore. But they have left a treasure of writings, of spiritual writings. They were spiritual teachers while they were here on this earth. They were truly bona fide mystics and seers and healers. And in fact, some of the people that they introduced me to were the same people that the founders of AA, which we borrowed our program from, used to read. They used to be a group that called themselves the Oxford Group. And what they used to do is they used to teach each other and study these spiritual things. And that's where AA came and eventually NA came. This is where we got our program from, our spiritual program, from these people. They designed this program. This is truly a spiritual program inspired by God. And I began to read these things, and I began to understand things. And what happened was that I began to understand that there are only two thought systems in the universe. Only two thought systems exist. And they are the thought system of fear and the thought system of love. They are the only two. And we believe in one or the other all the time, even when we're asleep. There is never a time when we believe in both of them at the same time, because love and fear cannot coexist. It's impossible. We cannot worship two masters at the same time. It's impossible. And there is never a time when we do not believe in either one, because there's no such thing as a neutral thought. It doesn't exist. And I began to understand that most of my life, I have worshipped the thought system of fear. In fact, fear is the only defect of character I have. I thought I had many, many defects of character, but I really don't. I only have one. It's fear. But fear manifests itself in many, many ways. It disguises itself in many, many ways. It disguises itself in resentment, in anger, in envy, in jealousy. In all these forms, you know, it's all fear. If you bring it all the way down, it's fear. And if we examine our mind and our thoughts, every thought that we have in our mind falls under the category of either love or fear. And the thought system of fear is the thought system that I have lived by all my life. This is why I've always been depressed. I've always been unhappy. I was a very violent young man. I was full of anger. I believed in scarcity, which is fear. And I realize now that was my defect of fear. And the antidote for that is the other thought system, which is a thought system that is completely and totally spiritual. It is a thought system of love. And this is what we have in our program. This is what our program teaches us. It teaches us a thought system of love. And the thought system of love also has many disguises and has many manifestations. And it comes in the form of understanding, of kindness, of honesty, of courage, of gentleness. And I begin to live by these principles. I begin to incorporate these principles in all my affairs. And one of the first things I did when I began to get involved with these principles, I knew I had to go home. And I called my wife and I said, "Honey, I want to come home." And I told her, you are not obligated to me for anything. I just want to come home and help you with the children. And I've been home ever since. One of the persons that has helped me more than anybody else is my oldest son. I have two sons, and they're so different. The little guy, he's very insecure and he's full of fear. And he needs a lot of love and he needs a lot of protection, and he's really a loner. He lives in a little world of his own, and we let him stay because he feels safe and secure there. And like I said, he's very insecure. My oldest son is the one that is something else. He's 22 years old now. He should have died 5 years ago. He's still alive. He's still alive. And I remember one morning we were sitting by the Sacramento River after I went back to my family. We moved up north and we got a little ranch there. I quit my job. I quit working. By that time I had invested the money that I had made and I didn't have to work anymore. They were my job. And I wanted to meet my family. I really didn't know my family. And so we moved up to this little ranch up in Redding, California. And I lived like I had never lived before. I grew all my table meat, all my beef and my lamb and my pork, and we had a half an acre of garden. We had a year-round garden. I had a horse for the children. They never rode the horse, but it was their horse. And we did a lot of camping, and we used to spend a lot of time in Lake Shasta. And I got to meet my family. And it was during the time, one time, my son, Tony, it was just before he went into his wheelchair. We were sitting by the Sacramento River early in the morning, and he turned to me and he says, "Papa," he says, "I know that that this situation between Eric and I is something that is very difficult, very hard for you to deal with. I've seen you, and I've heard you cry. He said, Papa, I wish you wouldn't worry, because I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not afraid. There's nothing to fear. He said, in fact, Papa, I'm just as perfect as I was in my creation. He says, I can't say that about my earth suit. That's what he calls his body, his little earth suit. He said, it's on the bum right now. He said, but whether it gets fixed or not is beside the point. There's nothing wrong with me. And then I realized something. I realized that he was safe. See, he was safe because he lives by the thought system of love. He lives by the thought system of the Spirit. You know, if I can turn my will and my life over to God, when I say God, I mean his thought system. Because God is love. God is truth. God is all these spiritual, we call them principles, but they are attributes of love. God is that. If I can turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I will be safe. There is no doubt in my mind that I will be safe because I have done it. I have experienced it. I have been able to turn my will and my life over to God, to love. And when that happens, I've experienced a temporary suspension of doubt and fear. I've experienced it in my life. See, because revelation reflects the original state between my Creator and myself. And when I make contact with God, I am in my original state between my Creator and myself. And there is no doubt and there is no fear. I've experienced very short times of it. And it's getting bigger and longer and bigger, and it's beginning to grow. I spend more and more time in that state. Today, in spite of the fact that there's a lot of problems in my life, this fellowship and working these principles of this fellowship has lifted me above these problems. They don't affect me like they used to affect me. I'm not sick anymore behind it. You know, at times, I still have problems, you know, because, you know, I'm still hypnotized to the thought system of the world. See, today I don't have a drug problem. I have an ego problem. And I'm still hypnotized to the thought system of the ego, which is the thought system of fear, because the ego is what creates fear. And many times I find myself caught in the fear. And like, for instance, sometimes I'm bathing my son, my youngest son. He's the one that is in more worse shape than the older one. He's very thin now, very, very thin, and his little back is very curved. He has scoliosis real bad. And when I'm bathing him, I see his body. And I start thinking, you know, will he be with me come this Christmas? Will he be gone? And I'm overcome with fear. And I have to stop and I have to meditate and I have to tell myself, my son is safe because there is no such thing as death. My son's true identity is spiritual. He is invisible. He is indestructible. He is holy, which is he is whole, complete. He's perfect. He's eternal. He's infinite. And the reason why I know that is because we are an extension of my Father. My Father and I are one. For many, many years, I think I was so depressed and so unhappy is because I believe, deep down in my heart, I believe I was separated from God. And it's not true. I've never been separated from God. I only believed I was separated from God. Taught me that is an illusion. See, I am an extent. My Father and I are one, so how can I be separated from Him? If I choose to make my bed in hell, my God will be there because He's part of me and I am part of Him. And since I am at one with my Father, I am at one with my Son. We will never be separated. There will be a time maybe in this world experience that it seems like we're separated. And during that time, I will grieve for Him. but I know that we'll be together. And when I can think about that, my fear leaves me. Then I can get on with the job of living. I can be helpful to him. I can be kind to him. I can be gentle and understanding. If it wasn't for this program, I would have never known what love is. And let me tell you something. It is not my love. It is God's love. All I have to do is become willing to let God manifest his love through me, to my family, to my friends, and even to my enemies. If I can do that, I experience God's love working through me. That's my reward. That's my happiness. That's my pleasure. And I thank this fellowship for teaching me this thought system, this thought system of love, because it has completely transformed me. I'm not the same man I was when I came here. I don't think like him. I don't live like him. I don't talk like him. I don't even look like him. You know, my oldest son told me something one day. He said, my oldest son is 22 years old. I got sober a year before he was born. And he told me something one day. He says, you know, Papa, I've heard you talk about your life before you got sober, and I just can't see it. I cannot picture you that you were that man that spent all those years in penitentiaries and in jails and in institutions and the man that did all those things that you did. I can't see it. You know, to me, you're the best father in the world. I can't see it. And I said, Tony, the program did that to me. He said, I know that. Because not only have I seen it in you, but I've seen it in your friends and the people who come to our home. I've seen them come new into the program, and I see them change. In very short time, I see them change. That's a beautiful program. In fact, he goes to a lot of meetings with me. My time is up. And once again, I want to say that it's a privilege for me. It's a privilege for me to come and share with you, because once again, I'm going home with much more than I came with. I sort of feel like, man, my pockets are full. I got everything I need and more. So as we drive home, let's all drive home safe, and may God be with all of us. Thank you very much.